Today's episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, a place to grow, connect, and serve. In-person services are back with some restrictions to help ensure everyone stays safe and healthy. For the latest, visit their website at canbyfoursquare.com.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey friends, and welcome to this episode of the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. Schools in many counties, including Clackamas, would not meet the strict COVID-19 standards for reopening that Governor Kate Brown announced in a press conference Tuesday afternoon with officials from the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Education. In order to resume any in-person learning, even under a hybrid model like the one being planned by Canby School District, a county needs to have fewer than 10 cases per 100,000 people for 3 weeks straight, with some exceptions for certain very small rural school districts. Based on Clackamas County's population of more than 418,187 people, the county would need to see a rate of cases 42 per week to meet this threshold. Last week, the county recorded 142 new cases, down only slightly from the previous week, which saw 145. That's not going to be good enough. With the first day of in-person school in Canby set for September 8th, the county would have to show a 70% reduction from its current weekly rate by August 17th to meet the criteria as outlined by state officials. We are taking a cautious and careful approach that protects public health, just as we have over the past 5 months in responding to this disease, the governor said. If we don't do this right, then the impacts of COVID-19 on students and the very functioning of our schools could deepen existing disparities in opportunity and outcomes for our children and widen racial and socioeconomic inequality in our society. Governor Brown acknowledged the importance of students receiving instruction and support in person, which numerous studies show produces better academic outcomes while fostering students' social and emotional well-being and their overall health. Regardless of when or whether classrooms are allowed to reopen in the fall, Governor Brown made clear that she expects districts to be ready to provide a robust system of learning, even from a distance. Oh, I am absolutely unwilling to lose an entire school year for kids, a year that could be foundational to the lifelong opportunities for thousands of Oregon students, she said. I will push, I will cajole, I will demand nothing but excellence from our districts and our educators, but it is also incumbent on all of us, every community, to take every measure to slow the spread of this disease so that we can get our kids back in schools as soon as possible. The Canby School District is among those who have been prepping for a hybridized reopening of classrooms this fall, one that would incorporate 2 days of in-person instruction with 3 days of learning from home each week. However, staff is also developing a fully distance learning program for families who would prefer it, and in the event that the county's COVID-19 numbers do not meet the requirements to safely reopen schools. More on the challenges of schooling in the coronavirus era. End of the session activities for a Canby School District summer school program were canceled this week after a staff member contracted COVID-19. the Camping Out podcast has confirmed. Other district employees were informed by email late Monday morning. A bilingual version of the message went out to community members and families that afternoon. As members of the school community, we understand that this raises concerns, Superintendent Tripp Goodall said in the message. We are working closely with Clackamas County Public Health to respond to this news and protect the health of our community. Based on the initial investigation, health authorities do not believe there is a high risk of exposure for staff or students, Goodall added. The district said that county contact tracers will be in touch with anyone they believe may have been exposed to this confirmed case. District spokeswoman Autumn Foster said summer school students are continuing to work remotely, as they have the entire session, though end-of-the-session activities have been nixed. Citing privacy concerns, she directed further inquiries about the employee's condition and the progress of the state's contact tracing to Clackamas County Public Health. We will be in touch soon about how students can return their devices, Goodall said in the email. We will only have final meal delivery to homes this Thursday. While this is not the way we envisioned ending our summer school program, we believe the safety and care of our staff and students is the highest priority. Goodall said the district is taking additional steps to clean and disinfect school facilities as the summer school session comes to a close. Kathleen Higgins-Jeske, a retired Canby school teacher and former vice president of the local teachers union, said she heard the news shortly after it went out to staff members. According to her, many instructors are apprehensive about returning to the classroom in the midst of a continuing coronavirus pandemic. Every teacher I know is very worried about going back, she said. Many have opted to do online or homeschool with their own kids this year, and many are making out or updating their wills. She has also heard from a number of parents who feel the same way from both Anglo and Latino families, she added. While children appear to be at much lower risk for experiencing serious complications from the virus, they, particularly those 10 and older, can contract and spread it as well as adults, Oregon public health officials have said. Teachers, on the other hand, are more likely to experience worse outcomes, particularly the one-third or so who are over the age of 55 or who have other underlying medical conditions. Jeske said the teachers she knows would much prefer interacting with students in person and outside of COVID-19 would be eager to get back to normal. They probably want to return to in-person more than anyone, she said, but only when it's safe. Some good news from Marquee at Hope Village this week. After almost 2 months, the state's second largest outbreak of COVID-19 at a long-term care facility has been resolved. As of Tuesday, Marquee Hope Village Post-Acute Rehab reports that all residents and employees who tested positive for the novel coronavirus are now considered recovered. Currently, we have no active symptomatic cases of coronavirus at Marquee Hope Village. Marquee Company Vice President of Clinical Services April Diaz told the Camping Out podcast in an email. All residents and staff are considered fully resolved per CDC guidelines. The outbreak officially began with test results that were confirmed on June 2nd, but Marquee officials now know the virus was widespread throughout the facility by then. The earliest known instance of the virus was an employee who showed symptoms on May 31st and later tested positive for the coronavirus, but Marquee and county public health officials have said the asymptomatic spread in this case was so wide that it would be impossible to trace to a single point of origin. Marquee implemented an aggressive testing regimen that included all residents and staff, not only at the post-acute rehab, but also the adjacent assisted living facility. Fortunately, the virus had not spread there, but it was rampant in the rehab facility. A total of 112 would eventually test positive, including 33 residents, 43 staff members, and 36 close contacts of employees, most likely family members or housemates. 11 deaths have been linked to the outbreak, all believed to be residents, though the company was able to confirm this for only 9. The other two happened outside the Camby facility, either a resident who died at the hospital or at a home, or a death that was discovered through contact tracing. In the state of Oregon, only the infamous healthcare at Foster Creek saw more cases, 120, and more deaths, they had 34. The nursing home in Southeast Portland was shut down by the state in May and has since been the target of millions of dollars of litigation by victims' families. Based on the lessons learned in the Cambie outbreak, Marquee Companies, which owns and operates 25 assisted living facilities in Oregon, Nevada, and California, has adopted a testing regimen even stricter than the governor's new guidelines for long-term care facilities, including weekly testing of surfaces and high-touch areas. The other key to Marquee limiting the spread of the virus was the heroic diligence of the facility's staff, according to the Marquee president and CEO, Phil Fogg Jr. The term hero gets thrown around, sometimes a little too generously, but in this environment, what our team members have worked through, well, there's no other word for it, Fogg told the Cambie Now podcast in May. I think the world of them. Hope Village leaders are planning a major expansion, one that would add 14 acres to the senior living community's 34-acre footprint and an additional 160 units to the campus's existing 392. The proposal would also add new type of housing, a three-story mid-rise apartment buildings, to its existing mix of cottages, duplexes, single-level, and low-rise, those are two-story units. The expansion has been in the works for years as part of the development's long-range planning, but was made official only recently when the proposal was filed with the City of Cambie. The Cambie Planning Commission is slated to consider the proposal on August 10th. The Hope Village nonprofit was established and began making plans for the senior living community in 1983, though the idea had actually been in the works since the 1950s. The first unit was built in 1997. Over recent years, Hope Village has acquired adjacent properties for the purpose of future expansion until enough additional area has been obtained to make expansion feasible, or so says the plan submitted to the city in support of Hope Village's proposed southern expansion. In cooperation with the developer of the recently purchased McMartin Farm, Hope Village has now obtained additional land directly adjacent to the south to allow for additional units to be added, along with access to public utilities and vehicle access from Ivy Street. The south expansion will be fully integrated into the existing campus, with streets, pathways, trails, and landscaping aimed at, quote, melding the two parts together, but officials admit it will differ in overall building design. Officials expect the addition of three-story mid-rise buildings that may present a marketing challenge, since it is a style of housing that has never been offered at Hope Village since the project began 40 years ago, so staff have spent time reviewing how other senior living communities have promoted mid-rise units. Planners have also taken pains to mitigate the new structure's impact on the existing sightlines for current residents. Hope Village has gone to great lengths to ensure the proposed combination of low and mid-rise buildings will become a part of the Hope Village campus, they said. Where possible, views and vistas will be protected, and there will be no dominating structures beyond the three-story mid-rise buildings. Officials say this type of housing is in demand for the senior market and will allow Hope Village to continue to offer a competitive mix of different housing options. Once completed, Hope Village will be able to offer a variety of housing types that are severely needed in the Cambie area, they say, noting the senior living community currently has a 2 to 3 year waiting list. The demand for senior housing is increasing constantly everywhere. This addition of the South Campus will likely make Hope Village one of the destination sites for seniors. Assuming Hope Village plans are approved, construction is likely to begin in 2021. It will be planned in four phases, anticipated to take about 2 years each, but may be accelerated based on market demands. For concept art and proposed layouts, you can find this article on our website at cambienowpod.com. Cambie Now Sports is brought to you by Reif and Hunziker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Cambie has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. After a dominant romp through the tournament competition this weekend, the Cambie Rebels softball team took home the title Sunday in their bracket of the 2020 North American Fast Pitch Association Summer Nationals, which were held in Newburgh. It was the second time the Rebels have won the annual tournament, which caps the summer softball season and draws teams from Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and California. The Rebels have also won three straight state titles from 2016 to 2018. Based in Canby and coached by former Canby High School standout athlete Ty Kraft, the Rebels are composed of some of the top high school talent from Canby and the surrounding communities, including four incoming CHS sophomores who form its core: center fielder Ava Carroll, catcher Ella Kyle, shortstop Kenna Kraft, and pitcher Reagan Rourke. Reagan Rourke has been our starter in all five of our championships, Kraft said after winning the final contest Sunday morning. She pitched a complete game today. She had a beautiful game. He spoke highly of all four of Canby's athletes, including his daughter Kenna, who swatted a triple to drive in three runs during a critical juncture of the final contest. He'll coach them at Canby High School this spring, assuming that the season goes forward. High school sanctioned sports fall under the jurisdiction of the Oregon School Activities Association and may fall under different coronavirus rules. As of this summer, softball leagues governed by NAFA were able to practice, scrimmage, play games, and even hold tournaments, but strict rules were in place in an attempt to curb the spread of COVID-19. Players, coaches, and support staff were required to wear face coverings inside athletic facilities, including the dugouts, but not on the field. Sharing equipment was prohibited, and a limited number of balls were issued to each team. Attendance at the games was also extremely limited. Most parents were required to watch the game from outside the arena, beyond the center field fence. The girls can't share bats, helmets, or any of the equipment, Kraft said. You can't high-five, can't get into group huddles. Being that we're outside as well, they do a really nice job of keeping that distance and making the play safe as much as we can. The challenges presented by the continuing pandemic made this weekend's victory all the sweeter, he said. Oh, it definitely does make it sweeter, he said. I think that everybody just kind of has the attitude that we're happy to be out here playing softball. The coronavirus did curtail the number of summer games the Rebels were able to play, from between 50 and 60 to only about 25. Still, the Canby team was able to play more scrimmages than most before the NAFA Summer Nationals, and the preparation showed. We came into the tournament having played more games than a lot of other teams, Kraft said. We were kind of a more in mid-season form. Our pitchers were pitching really well, managing the games really well. The Rebels won every game by the mercy rule, which stops a game after five innings if one team is winning by seven runs or more. They took the championship game Sunday, 10-3. Kraft gave a lot of credit to the city of Canby, which owns Maple Street Park. The team was not able to use the Canby School District's facilities, as current OSAA and school guidelines prohibit access to rec teams, community groups, and other third parties. Oh, the city's been really great to work with, Kraft said. They've been allowing us to put protocols in place, allowing us to practice and even have scrimmages and games. We're doing the things that we can do, but we're really trying to be safe about it too. Some outbreaks of the novel coronavirus have been linked to high school athletics this summer, one of the largest of which was a youth baseball team in Newburgh, where the NAFA tournament finals were held. Kraft said the health and safety of their athletes, families, and community is a top priority and something they take very seriously. But he also feels that keeping sports and the lives of student athletes, if possible, is an important part of their health and overall well-being too. I definitely don't take the coronavirus lightly. What an awful thing it is, how it's impacted people and will continue to impact people until we can get a handle on it, Kraft said. But from the mental health side of it for our kids, I think it's critical to do what we can to get them some sort of normalcy in their daily lives, so when they wake up in the morning, they have something to look forward to.
Hey, Frankie, do you ever wonder why some businesses aren't, like, more transparent?
Oh, yeah. Like, some of the old buildings downtown are so dark. Get some more windows,
no,
you know?
No. I mean, like, transparent as in being open and honest about their business practices.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, DirectLink is a good example. They don't have internet data caps or charge extra fees for high usage.
Oh, yeah. Which is great with all the internet I've been using since this whole COVID situation started.
They also don't charge infrastructure build fees like some other providers. And they're active in our community, too. Check out their philanthropic efforts at directlink.coop/community.
Did you know that they also hold an annual meeting every year where members can talk directly with the board of directors and upper management?
Talk about transparent. You won't see any other companies being that accessible. DirectLink really is here for us. Call 503-266-8111 or visit directlink.coop to learn more today.
All right, joining me on the CAMI conversation today is Pamela Hayden with Hopkins Demonstration Forest and Forest Forever. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Nice to see you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us out here in this gorgeous place. We're here on site at Hopkins Demonstration Forest and standing before a very unusual structure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it just to get started?
Well, we found the structure. Actually, we put the structure on the Clackamas County Inventory of Historic Properties back in 1984. Mm-hmm. That's how I first became involved with it when I worked for the county. And we knew it was a really important structure, but we knew so little about it. We didn't know where it was built. We didn't know who built it or why they built it.
So where was it found? And that, as you kind of alluded to, the place it was found is not believed to be its original location.
Right. We first located it at the corner of Wildcat and Wilhoit Road, which is south of Mullala, about 4 miles, really a remote area.
Yeah.
On Rock Creek. Uh-huh. And we believe that it was moved in, we know that it was moved in 1892 because of local lore and tax records, et cetera. But we didn't know exactly where it was moved from. So that was quite a long research project just to try to figure out where it was first built.
Yeah.
We think we know, but we don't.
And your line of work is local lore is it all you have sometimes to go on?
There's historic research is, you know, in-depth historic research, you can go on forever and ever and ever.
Right.
But their local lore is important. And obviously, pioneer records, you know, that's where we first started looking through the research records, was during the pioneer times, and didn't find any evidence of or documentation of why this building was there. So did some dendrochronology work and some log end work. We could see erosion in the logs that were so much more so than other like 1850s pioneer log structures. And so we got to thinking, well, and looked at the tree rings and there was evidence that it could be really old.
Yeah.
And as old as say 1799. Mm-hmm. And that was just mind blowing because there's no documentation here in Clackamas County that there were people here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's altogether possible. Yeah. White people. Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. No, I know. Yeah.
Foreigners, right. Europeans, yeah, that would build this.
Settlers.
Native Americans certainly built some log structures, but nothing like this.
Yeah, yeah. So this is known as a Mullala
log house.
And as you're kind of talking, we're not sure exactly when it's built, but there's some, at least some believe this is the oldest existing structure.
Probably in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
That we know of.
Yeah.
And it's a mystery. We don't know for sure. It's called controlled speculation. You look at all the research, all the data, the way the building's built, the age of the logs, and then you look at the culture of the people that could have built it and then when they could have come. And so you make some speculation that this is what could have happened, mm-hmm. even though it wasn't written down in history. It was in nobody's journal,
right.
One of those old guys' journals.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your best guess?
My best guess is that it was built by Canadian fur traders and hunters, probably who came over the Rocky Mountains in the 1790s at some point. It was a very active time for the fur trade. They were building log structures across Canada and into the Rocky Mountains and over into the British Columbia area. And it could have been some of those folks with Scottish or English heritage, Métis, which would be oftentimes they had the European fur traders had native wives and they had all children. And a lot of times those were the ones that were the big explorers out. And they were the interpreters and the ones that knew the lay of the land so that they could have taken people over the Rocky Mountains and showed them in the Willamette Valley. Mm-hmm. Or in the Columbia River area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It has a very unusual type of construction. We've been looking at that before we turned the recorder on. But when you just say the word log house, I know my brain goes to, and probably a lot of other people think like the Lincoln Logs, you know, big round logs, little house on the prairie type deal. And this is very different. These are, hand hewn, so not super smooth, but some semblance of flatness and fit together.
Yes.
And then without the use of any nails or anything.
That's right. They were hand hewn. It's considered to be a fairly small structure, but pretty typical of the size of structure in the fur trade for houses. It's an 18 by 25. The logs were hewn square, about 8 8 inches in squared, and they're fit together at the ends with half dovetail notching, which is interesting. It's a very efficient notch. It lets the water drain and holds the building very tight together. The interesting thing about this building is that that there are no spaces between the logs. Mm-hmm. In a lot of the pioneer buildings, you would find spaces between the logs because of shrinkage or whatever, or either the craftsmanship wasn't as good, and they would have to stuff it with chinking and daub it with, you know, all sorts of different kinds of materials, clay or whatever, to seal out the weather. This one was built so fortified against the weather. It was also built as a fortified-looking structure that would have kept out arrows or even musket balls. Mm. It's a very efficient, almost military-like structure.
Yeah, you were saying that it had some semblance of military,
like a blockhouse.
Yeah,
it's not built like a blockhouse, but it's built with the same design concept. It's sort of it's a Scandinavian tradition of building, and it could have been taught through the generations across Canada from the original people that came to America from Sweden and Norway and Finland.
About how many people do you think would have lived here? How many people do you think it took to build something?
We think there was probably a crew of about 10 people that built it. How long they stayed, we don't know. You know, they could have come and stayed one season. And oftentimes, these structures, they would have occupied them for one winter and then for some reason abandoned it and gone to someplace else to have better hunting.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long the original builders were here, but they certainly didn't stay long, and they didn't leave their mark, because we don't know in history exactly what happened.
Yeah.
We do know, though, that Freeman hunters and trappers occupied places within the Willamette Valley, and this could have easily, my partner in this, Greg Olson, always says this was the best house in the Willamette Valley at the time. There's no way no one would have lived in it if it had been abandoned.
Right. Yeah. Why not? Okay, so this was found, as you mentioned, back in the 80s, not in great shape. It needed some work.
In the 1980s, it was in pretty good shape. Okay. It still had a good roof on it. In the 90s, the Board of County Commissioners designated it a historic landmark in Clackamas County. Mm-hmm. It still was in pretty good shape. By 2007, though, it started, the roof had collapsed, and I was doing a bike tour of the area of barns, and there were some people from the Malala Area Historical Society that were with me, and they became very interested in saving this building, realizing that maybe we could contact the owner, and the owner would donate it to the Malala Area Historical Society, and then we could restore it. So that sort of started the project, and since that time, I've written grants it's probably spent almost $200,000 on this project so far, and mostly from the Kinsman Foundation.
Yeah.
We've had help from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, as well as the Clackamas County Cultural Coalition.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of volunteers. We've had, you know, a lot of the wood that's been donated.
Yeah.
And the storage of the logs up at Bull Run Powerhouse to storage, those people also donated the storage for 5 years, which is, I just wrote a letter today thanking them, saying that was worth $30,000 in itself, just being able to store the logs there. So
And you mentioned in terms of the donated lumber, you try to find like the old growth fir and hew them. Uh-huh. The crews that have been working on it have tried to replicate those same types of techniques that would have been used.
Exactly. This building was built with Douglas fir, and the two craftsmen that have been working on it are expert carpenter craftsmen, have worked with log buildings before. And so they were very knowledgeable, and they're also both very knowledgeable about historic renovation, and try to do it as original as possible. Don't make changes that you think. You try to do what the building tells you what it was. We're having an interesting time with the roof, because we really don't know what the original roof looked like. Mm. We found it, as I say, in 2007 when we dismantled it, there was evidence of four different roofs, but that had been done since 1892. Mm. So what exactly the roof looked like before that, before it was moved, we don't know. But the interesting thing with the roof is they have these beautiful peeled poles that fit naturally into notches in the top plate of the roof without the need for nails. So that's interesting. There's absolutely no nails used in this house.
You were showing me on the boards that form this first floor on the bottom, how the craftsmen tried to replicate those same axe marks, that
is I wonder kind of what they think about this process. You mentioned they've done stuff like this before, mm-hmm. but
well, I'm not sure they've done anything exactly like this before.
Well, there's nothing like this in Oregon.
Yeah. So Greg Olson, who's really the expert craftsman, who's been the prime contractor on this project, Greg could tell the personalities of the axemen, each one. He could tell how many people there were because of the different, and some were left-handed or some were right-handed. Oh, no way. Some were much more precise.
Some had more of a temper. Yeah. On.
But there's certainly evidence of very high qualified expert craftsmen, which is interesting. So whoever these people were, they brought with them builders.
Right.
They were prepared to build.
Right. How can you tell us a little bit about how we came to be here in this beautiful Hopkins Demonstration Forest, which is just perfect setting,
yes,
you say?
Yes. For this. Hopkins Demonstration Forest is just a gorgeous environment, and we got really lucky. It actually was through the Malala River Alliance. I was going around the state giving PowerPoint presentations, trying to get people interested in the project and interested in helping me find a site. And so it was through the Malala River Alliance that a gal who had been on the board of directors here saw my PowerPoint, and she came to the board and suggested that they might want to at least see the PowerPoint. So I came and showed it up at this beautiful Everett Hall up here. I don't know if you've been inside, but it's gorgeous. And so I showed the PowerPoint, and the board voted, and they said, okay, we'll take it. Oh, you can be on the board. We'll take it with you as well.
It was a package deal.
Yeah. Well, because I've been the grant writer and the, orchestrator sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Pam, what motivates you? What has motivated you over the years to do what you can to protect this piece of history?
Yeah, I've worked for 32 years for Clackamas County, and I was working much of that time as a historic preservation planner.
Yeah.
So I worked with putting all the historic structures in the county on the inventory, and then worked to get the really important ones onto the Clackamas County landmarks list and protected through that.
Yeah.
This was one of them. And this particular building, it just grew, the passion grew. And the more research I did, the more interesting it was. And Greg Olson's love, and Rich Iceberg, who also works with them, their love of this beautiful wood and their good craftsmanship, just snowballed into this passion.
Yeah.
and it's one of those things.
Yeah. Where are we going with this? Obviously, we're still in the midst of the restoration. Not sure, are we, sort of how long that will take?
Well, we hope to have this complete by the fall of this year.
Oh, cool.
And then we'd like to get the grounds a little bit more coiffed so that we could have demonstrations here.
Cool.
And be able to show how the wood was hewn. This is a demonstration forest. So,
right.
So have a lot of school kids come, high school kids come, show them how buildings like this were built, and have interpretive panels that talk about the building and its history, and and be a part of the programming. We're also doing a film project to document it that we hope that can be shown, say, at places like the End of the Oregon Trail or the Clackamas County Museum, so that we can share our information with them and share visitors and kind of share promotional material so that people can enjoy it. We just would like people to be able to enjoy it. That's really why we saved it. It's a part of our history, and it's really important.
Why do all this work?
Yeah.
It's
a really important part of our history that's undocumented, I think.
Yeah.
It's something that we don't know that much about. We do see a little bit of this interpretation at Champouy with the first French Canadians at the French Prairie. So this, I think, shares some history with that. Mm-hmm. So
very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of kids, as you guys can hear, obviously, as always, have my children with us here in the background. But it's such a gorgeous, peaceful setting. I am just, so personally blown away with all the work that it must have taken to make this happen, and so appreciative that you guys did do that work to save it, because, this is one of a kind. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way to recreate this. We could just draw a picture of it or pretend, but to actually have it is really cool and a real value statement, I think, for the county and the state. So thank you, Pam. Anything to add?
Well, thank you for having interest and for sharing this more broadly. Yeah. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So definitely check out our website and social media for some of the photos that we've taken out here. Yeah. And are there places that people can go either online or on social media to check progress, to kind of stay tuned to what's going on?
We do have, at the Hopkins Demonstration Forest website, we do talk about this building, and we'll be sharing more. It's kind of like we go in stages of what we're doing, but we do definitely plan to have much more information online for people to view in the future.
Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time, and sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Well, friends, we're going to draw this episode of the Canby Now podcast towards a close with this episode of Canby Then. This time it's brought to you by Retro Revival, not your average antique shop. They're open daily, and you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby, or connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. They say all's fair in love and war, but that doesn't necessarily mean all's love in war and fair. Indeed, a war of words was fought in 1908 over control of the fledgling Clackamas County Fair, and Canby was the winner. The fair had started in Gladstone and was a smashing success, but enterprising folks in Canby thought they could do better, and they had just the spot in mind, a beautiful 40-acre plot on the east side of town on land once owned by Supreme Court Chief Justice Aaron E. Waite and still held by his descendants. Led by the Canby Development League, Chairman R.S. Coe, and 23 other league members, the town was ultimately successful in bringing the fair to Canby, where it would remain for the next 112 years, at least. A groundbreaking was held in late July 1918 to begin construction on the fairgrounds' buildings and a first-class racetrack, and it was a festive occasion. Local officials came out in droves to view the beautiful grounds and make speeches under a stand of drooping fir trees. The mayor of Canby, J.F. Mitz, had proclaimed the day a local holiday, and many downtown businesses closed their storefronts in honor of the momentous occasion. Canby's Silver Comet Band met visitors at the old train depot, which I guess back then would have been the new train depot, and whisked them through a grand processional to where the ceremonies would be taking place. Numerous delegates from surrounding communities were there to, quote, rustle on the sidelines and make all the noise as needed, as recorded by the Oregonian. Judge Grant Dimmick, whose later exploits would reveal him to be one of the most sinister rogues in the county's history, exhorted his listeners to do all in their power to make the fair a success by talking and working for the enterprises in season and out of season, according to the Canby Tribune's chronicling of the event. Another early fair booster, Professor Theodore Gary, went even further. Mr. O'Gary advised everyone to boot up, and if we hear anyone talking against the fair, to take him out and hang him, or something to that effect, the newspaper noted. His remarks were timely and well-received. Well, no hangings were recorded, but the work on the new fairgrounds came together splendidly. Out of the Waite family's rich farm and forest grew barns, arenas, stadiums, and outbuildings, some of which still stand to this day. Unlike the 1907 fair, which had been headlined by a gaudy carnival from out of town, which included a mask ball, Mardi Gras, freak show, and family feud-style contests, the centerpiece of the Canby Fair would be its sparkling new horse racing track. The half-mile racetrack has been placed in order during the past few days and is pronounced by experts to be one of the finest tracks in the state, the Oregonian declared. WH Council is directing the grader, steamroller, and sprinkler at the fairgrounds, and the racetrack will be in first-class condition. Cash prizes of up to $1,000 were awarded to the fastest horses, thanks to liberal contributions from Portland businessmen and across the state. Not that it was all about speed. Slow trotting was also a popular form of racing entertainment in those days, and several were scheduled for the three-day event. A five-mile relay race for pupils of the local schools was also considered an interesting feature. Other prizes would be given to top show performers for horses, cattle, sheep, swine, poultry, vegetables, fruit, and all kinds of farm products. Awards will be given for ladies' textile products, bread, cakes, pies, preserved fruits, etc., the Oregonian said. 50 special prizes will be awarded for the best of exhibits of every kind of farm, garden, or horticultural product. The most popular day was Friday, which had been designated Oregon City Day, something that had also been done at the 1907 fair. According to an earlier article, the entire town promises to pay a Canby a visit and enjoy the raptures of country life for a day. Well, that might have been an exaggeration, but not by much. 3,000 souls visited the Clackamas County Fair that day, and almost a third of them from Oregon City, which in those days had a population of just north of 4,000. There were so many folks from Oregon City, a special train was on hand just to take them home at the end of the night. The attendance was far greater than was anticipated by the fair officials, a newspaper later recorded, and was due partly to the perfect weather and in no small measure to the fact that nearly 1,000 people came from the county seat to make a boost for the old Clackamas and her fine products that filled the big pavilion. The display of products of the soil were amazing in variety and quality, though not so numerous as the previous year due to a late frost. Nevertheless, the mammoth vegetables and luscious fruits grown by the family farms that thickly encircled the community and its fairgrounds attracted wide attention. The horse races, though, were widely considered to have been far superior to the previous years. They were more and better horses in competition, nearly 500 in number, and the crowds poured in from all directions to see them pound the dirt. The fair wrapped up with an exhibition baseball game, with a hometown team hosting the Spantons from Portland. With one of the night boys on the mound and pitching a no-hitter, the Canby Bats got hot and spanked the visitors 16-0. That's what I call an old-fashioned thrashing. The fair had found its permanent home, and in the rich Canby soil, it was prepared to grow and grow. That, however, is a story for next time on Canby Then. Well, friends, as always, thank you for listening. I'm James Walton. Have a great day.
Hey, Frankie, you okay? You seem kind of down.
Yeah, just bummed. Miss going to the Wild Hair. I know you can still get takeout and all, but it's just not the same.
You know they're open again, right?
What?
Yeah, they've been open for a while now. Don't you cover, like, the news?
Hey, I'm only human, okay?
Okay. Well, I can tell you that the Wild Hare and their amazing staff are thrilled to be open again for delicious meals and fun times. They are strictly following all the recommended safety guidelines, and they have the only covered outdoor patio in Canby, with lots of tables spaced 6 feet apart and umbrellas also spaced 6 feet apart, and fantastic ambiance. And hey, if you're still more comfortable with carryout, they can hook you up there too. Find their menu and other information online at thewildhairsaloon.net or check them out in Canby and Oregon City. Anything to add, Frankie? Frankie? Oh, I guess he left. God, he must have been really hungry. The Can Be Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Can Be by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Can Be Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Can Be Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.